I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Shirley Sherrod says she will sue Andrew Breitbart, the blogger who took her words out of context and launched a firestorm on race.
Andrew Breitbart, at this point, you know, he hasn't apologized. I don't want it at this point. And he'll definitely hear from me.
And just to follow up on that, there have been reports that you are considering a lawsuit. Have you decided whether you're going to pursue that action?
I will definitely do it.
So you're
definitely going to sue. Yes.
Shirley Sherrod answering a reporter's question at the annual convention of the National Association of Black Journalists, which is meeting in San Diego this week. The fired USDA official said she hadn't decided on whether to take her old job back or take a new job offered by an apologetic administration. But she did say President Obama needs a little lesson in issues of equality and that he and Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack could use more black advisors. Well, joining us from San Diego is Mary Curtis, national correspondent for PoliticsDaily.com. And Mary, Shirley Sherrod's appearance was a last-minute addition. Andrew Breitbart was supposed to attend but didn't. What was the reaction to her being there?
Well, I think people were happy that we had a newsmaker. We always like to do that at this conference because it's, of course, a bunch of journalists. Mm-hmm. And her husband, Charles Sherrod, a civil rights activist, was in the audience. So it was quite an interesting and kind of an electric atmosphere.
Well, especially since Shirley Sherrod said that young people in America are shielded from the hurt and pain suffered by past generations of blacks. Now, let's remind ourselves, she was the daughter of a farmer in the Jim Crow South who was killed by a white man who wasn't prosecuted. And in fact, in her speech, she said she'd overcome feelings about whites to help a white farmer save his farm. But that's her background. She seemed to be saying younger blacks aren't aware of that. Do you think she meant President Obama? Did she mean new leaders of the NAACP who were slow to defend her? Did she mean the black press?
Well, I think she actually mentioned young whites and young blacks, young people in general, that we are so anxious in this country to become one and to get past unpleasantness that we really don't teach the real harsh struggles of the civil rights era. And she said when these young people get into positions, they don't have that background to inform them. And someone mentioned this, do you mean the president? And she said, yes, indeed. And so she wasn't angry. In fact, she's a very calm person. But she chided him a little bit and said, you know, she had offered to take him through Southwest Georgia and to show him sort of the progress we've made, but also the fact that there's still a lot of work to do.
But what about the questions being asked by the black press regarding this incident? You know, everybody's now apologetic, feeling that they rushed to judgment.
Well, I think this incident spotlights the fact that there could be more diversity in media, because there were black voices in the media talking about these issues, black columnists and so forth. But a lot of the cable shows, they don't regularly have a lot of diversity in those roundtable discussions.
Well, what about diversity in the White House? Sherrod also said President Obama needs more black advisors. Maureen Dowd, of course, quoted black Congressman John Lewis, James Clyburn, and Eleanor Holmes Norton this past weekend saying the very same thing. But then today on the Today Show, NBC's Chuck Todd said that her statements yesterday were a setback for the White House, that the Obama White House wants issues of race to get off the radar, and that her saying she's going to sue puts them right back on.
Well, I think there's a realization that if the White House is skittish when it comes to issues of race, that it would be disingenuous to not acknowledge the reasons why they feel this way. Because some of the attacks on President Obama, let's face it, have been race-based, that he favors African-Americans, that even he's not a legitimate citizen. But the pressure that leads to that overreaction doesn't excuse the overreaction. You know, she said that when she was dealing with the White House and with the USDA, that there needs to be more minority representation. And she talked about discrimination within the USDA, not just in the black farmer's suit, but in the organization itself.
You mentioned the black farmer's suit. These are black farmers who are suing, saying they haven't had the same kind of subsidies and attention from the USDA as white farmers. I think she went so far as to say we're about to see the last of black farmers because of that.
Oh, definitely. And there has been a settlement because there were proven issues of discrimination, and they've had a difficult time getting some of those payments made. And in the meantime, many of the farmers are getting older and they're dying. And so she felt that by joining the government, that she would be helping to change it from within. And then this is what happened.
Right. But we want to ask you, we understand Michael Steele, the African-American chair of the Republican Party, is going to appear at the conference later today. What questions would you have for him?
One question is I have for him is I think that he is scheduled to appear at a fundraiser in California in August with Andrew Breitbart. And I wonder if he thinks that Andrew Breitbart should apologize, if he has any questions for him, if he approves or disapproves of his actions in this incident, and if he's going to still continue to do that.
And what about accusations that the Republican Party hasn't distanced itself enough from aspects of racism in the Tea Party movement or from an Andrew Breitbart?
I would ask him about that as well, because recently you have the caucus, the Tea Party caucus, and a lot of Republican politicians are joining that. So I would ask him if he feels that there is a question of some racism in the fringe parts of the Tea Party. Does he feel that there's any piece of it that needs to be disavowed by the Republican Party?
Mary Curtis, national correspondent for PoliticsDaily.com, speaking to us from the National Association of Black Journalists convention underway this week in San Diego. Mary, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Well, race came up in President Obama's appearance this week on ABC's The View. He was asked why he identifies himself as African-American and not multiracial, and he talked about something he realized as a teenager.
Part of what I realized was that if the world saw me as African-American, then that wasn't something that I needed to run away from. That's something that I could go ahead and embrace. And the interesting thing about the African-American experience in this country is that we are sort of a mongrel people. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all kind of mixed up.
Yeah.
Well, as we'll hear, President Obama might have had help adjusting from his white mother. What is it like to grow up mixed race in America? Laws against interracial marriage are gone, but Bob Jones University banned interracial dating only in 2000. Mixed race kids can feel comfortable in two worlds, but also lonely in both. Kip Fulbeck, who you might remember, put together the book Part Asian, 100% Hapa, Hapa being the Hawaiian word for a person of mixed Asian or Pacific Island descent, has a new book. It's called Mixed Portraits of Multiracial Kids. He's an artist and professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and joins us from KCLU in Thousand Oaks, California. Kip, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be back.
And we're also thrilled to have with us author and educator Dr. Maya Sutoro-Ing, who's written the foreword to your book. She's also the younger half-sister of President Barack Obama. She joins us from Hawaii Public Radio in Honolulu. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin. Happy to be here.
And I want to start with you. You shared with Barack Obama the same white American mother. Your father, though, was a brown Indonesian man, as you say. You and your mom have a collection of photographs of you straddling borders, like the border between China and Pakistan, because you straddle cultures.
I absolutely do. And I'm not so easily identified as being part of a particular group because there is no large Indonesian community in the United States. No one would look at me and say, ah, look at that Indonesian woman. So in a way, that has given me more freedom. It has made it harder for me to find easy community, perhaps, but it has allowed me to connect with a lot of different people in so many communities in this country and elsewhere. Other people who also feel like they have identities on the borderlands. And it has afforded me, at least, this ability to feel like I belong everywhere.
Well, you write, in Indonesia, people thought you were American. In the U.S., people think you're Indonesian. But in Turkey, they think you're Turkish. In Italy, Italian. And Kip, I just want to, you know, bring you in here because your mom is Cantonese, your father, American-born mix, English, Irish, Welsh. And like Dr. Sutoro-Ing, you really resent when, for instance, census forms come along and you're forced to pick.
Yeah, I've never been a fan of having to pick the one box. You know, you got to realize that I was born in 65. I was born at a time where many states still had laws that made my parents' marriage illegal. And so when it says check one box only, what that box really says to me is pick mom or dad. And it's unfair to ask a kid to decide. And so I've always been fighting against that. And even the census now, we celebrate the fact that 10 years ago we allowed people for the first time to check more than one box. It's still a very limited palette of boxes. It still accentuates this idea of difference. You know, there's conflicts that you can't. Why can't you check Hispanic? Why isn't that a race? Why can't you check Jewish? Why isn't that a race? When if we really want to get down to biological race, that everyone listening to your show is African.
Well, and so you put together these beautiful pictures of kids who are also multiracial. But even as I say that, Kip, you write that that's sort of a burden that's borne by kids who are multiracial because, I don't know, explain what that is, that we sort of in cooing over them and saying how beautiful they are, it has a touch of what for you?
Yeah, the idea of the word exotic, it's not always a compliment. It can be distancing as well. It's like you're exotic because you are different. So when a well-meaning stranger fawns over a child saying, well, look at your eyes and look at your hair texture and so forth, it's really accentuating this idea that you are different from the mainstream. And what I wanted to do in this book is show that these kids are all part of our mainstream, that multiracial identity has been part of our country for centuries, since the beginning.
I just wanted to add that when you exoticize someone, you are creating the other, again and again. And I think that othering is really problematic. I think about in Indonesia, the Indo, that is the half Indonesian, half other child, is always said to be the most beautiful. They are welcomed as movie stars and pop culture icons. However, they are also regarded as not entirely trustworthy, and they are depicted in literature and in popular images as being somehow inscrutable and disloyal. And so you have these dual experiences, one supposedly positive, but it's layered with a lot of sort of negative baggage and assumptions.
And I just want to touch on one thing, Maya, that you write about, that often the issues that mixed-race kids deal with as they grow older, perhaps, and realize more who they are, can't be understood by their parents unless their parents also are mixed race. I mean, you write, Maya, about, really when you were young, you're a teenager, you wanted to blend in, you wanted to belong.
I absolutely did. And to my mother's credit, she was the one who constantly reminded me that I had sort of a gift. She thought of me as a wonderful interpreter and mediator between cultures. And when I started studying Spanish and salsa and wanted to read Gabriel Garcia Marquez, I remember she said to me, Latino culture is really beautiful, but why aren't you doing anything with Indonesia and with the gift of belonging to that world that you were given? And I think that what she was trying to say is that I had an insider's vision and perspective that would allow me to really help solve problems and be a peacemaker between people of Indonesia and the United States, or between East and West, and that I was not necessarily taking advantage of that.
But you're making the point that mixed-race kids need to air their feelings, that looks are superficial, but confusion about the way you look or how you're treated because of how you look, that's not superficial. That's Dr. Maya Sotoring, the younger half-sister of President Barack Obama. More with her and author Kip Fulbeck in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking today about mixed race and the book Mixed, Portraits of Multiracial Kids. The foreword written by Dr. Maya Sotoring, the younger half-sister of President Obama. It's put together by artist and author Kip Fulbeck. There are photos. Here's Jetta, African-American, Puerto Rican, Dominican, and Italian. Here's Ali, a Korean and Jewish. She's playing with a crayon in her photo. And then there's a comment from her mom. Now, her mom grew up the only Hapa kid in an all-white town. Hapa, again, the Hawaiian word for mixed Asian or Pacific Island descent. And the mom writes, I got picked on a lot. So she worried that her daughter looked too Korean or too Jewish, and writes, I now realize she's just perfect. So Kip Fulbeck, do you think this means things have changed in the few decades since you and Maya Sotoring were kids?
Things have absolutely changed. I mean, without a doubt, we're moving glacially forward. It's not fast, but it's really, really changed. When I grew up, I mean, I made these books because I didn't know any other kids like me. We didn't have an Apollo Ono in the Olympics. We didn't have a Betty Wynn doing news, or Keanu Reeves, or a Halle Berry, or a President Obama. The reason I asked Cher to do the afterword was because the first 45 record I ever bought as a kid was the song Half Breed. by Cher, which you know, I just liked the song. I didn't realize that this was the first sort of mainstream acknowledgement of mixed identity in pop music.
It was about you.
Yeah, it just wasn't around. So I think it's really, really different now. The kids have a very, very different world.
Let's hear some of that song. Kip, I want to ask you about that startling study commissioned by CNN. It found that both white and black children are biased in favor of images of whites and prejudiced against images of blacks. And that would mean for black and presumably many mixed-race kids, kind of a self-hate. You say this points to an ingrained sort of free-floating racism.
The idea of ingrained racism does not go away in one generation or two generations. It's a clawing, gnawing, stubborn prejudice that we have to get rid of. And when you realize that, I take these statements from these kids in this book, and you look at what a role model means, and you look at this one kid that writes down that I am brown like Barack Obama. One day I'll be a pro football player and the president. You realize how much having someone like President Obama in office means just in terms of an image for a kid. And the fact that this is just happening now, of course these prejudices are going to stay with us because we don't have these role models in any kind of mass form yet, but we're getting there.
Well, you also realize just how many mashups, if you will, there are. I'm looking at Suhaila. She's Malay, Indonesian, Scottish, Irish, Hakka, and Cantonese. What's Hakka?
Hakka.
Maya, you want to handle this?
Yeah.
She's a special one.
So Suhaila is my daughter.
Oh!
Yeah. Hakka is a Chinese ethnicity, so of course within China and within Chinese diaspora, there's no one Chinese, and so Hakka is the ethnic group on her grandpa's side. And my father-in-law actually speaks Hakka as his first language.
Well, the combinations are amazing. Here's Seth. He's Laotian, Cambodian, Chinese, Danish, and French. Here's Kino, Mexican, Hawaiian, Chinese, Russian, and Portuguese. Were you struck as well, Kip, by how many combinations there are?
I was not struck by how many combinations since I've been doing work about this for so long, but I was struck by how many people came forward to be part of these books. I only shot in California, Hawaii, and New York, and I realized that there are just millions and millions of these kids and families that want to be involved that said, like, it's about time we talked about this. We want our children to grow up in a world that acknowledges this. And so I was really struck by the enthusiasm with which people came forward for the project.
And enthusiastically embracing new names for themselves. Blaxican?
I like that. She just came up with that herself. That was the mom. That's the mother of the young boy in the cover. And she wrote that he's Blaxican, and I teach him to be very proud that he's come from two very oppressed cultures, and he should find strength from that.
Mexican, yeah. And African-American. Well, Kip, you've said that the one thing you want to get across is that kids of mixed race should never bear the burden of being the symbol of everything being okay. You know, the fact that they exist means there is no more racism.
Right.
So we want to make sure we've said that. But as we say goodbye, who are some of your favorites? I mean, I'm just going through here. And
Oh, my God.
I know. It's hard to pick.
I shot 500 kids for this one, and I do have one favorite. Her name is Julia. She's Japanese and Italian, and she's holding an orange shirt and holding up a little rock. And the reason she's my favorite is you got to realize that these photo shoots, it's pretty cacophonous. You've got a lot of families there. You've got a lot of kids, I mean, assistants, and it's pretty intimidating for some young kids. And oftentimes they come in, they're a little scared at first. Julia walks in. She's probably 4 years old, and she just walked right up to me and said, "Do you want to see my rock collection?" And I said, "Yes." And she just sat down and said, "Okay, this is aquamarine, and this is jade agate, and this is," and I absolutely fell in love with her because she was just so upfront. This is what I'm into. I'm into rocks. And her statement was, "I love people and animals and minerals and plants."
Okay. Well, and Maya, we know your favorite, your daughter.
I am partial. Yeah. She has just learned to read this year, and it's so much fun to watch her engaging with the world of print everywhere. And her new preferences are sharks and Navi. She watched the movie Avatar, and so now dresses up in all blue and makes me put a single braid down the back of her hair. And then she has a blue Amazonian stuffed snake who she named Pandora. And she tied ribbons and braided Pandora's ribbons as well. So she's an interesting character.
That's Dr. Maya Sudororing. She's an author and educator, also happens to be the half-sister of President Barack Obama. And Kip Fulbeck, author of Mixed Portraits of Multiracial Kids, terrific book. We'll have at our website more about the book, more pictures. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Wildlife officials in Montana are testing the DNA of that captured grizzly bear, trying to determine whether the 400-pound animal killed one camper and seriously injured two others in the Gallatin National Forest at the edge of Yellowstone National Park, a park that spans the Montana-Wyoming border. The bear and all three of her cubs have now been captured. The attack has stunned wildlife experts, since random attacks that don't involve, say, food left out, are rare. John Heine is director of the Grizzly and Wolf Discovery Center in West Yellowstone, Montana, where he runs educational programs about grizzlies. And John, a lot of people, animal activists in particular, would say that animals have every right to be angry at humans in their territory. There are warning signs that this was, you know, bear country. But the attack seemed predatory, which is very rare. How difficult has it been to figure out why?
It's really tough, and I know that the biologists are going to be out there really scouring that campsite to make sure that everyone was doing the right things, you know, making sure that the food was secured or they weren't sleeping in clothes that they were cooking in, and making sure the garbage was where it was supposed to be. And it sounds like everybody was doing the right things, and it just could be one of those random, off-the-charts behaviors that kind of show up every once in a great while.
But we understand that most recently there was an attack in 2008, which seems, you know, too close for comfort.
You know, I know it's not the same bear, and the bears could have learned something. You know, maybe there was a cub of a sow that was doing things that weren't necessarily very acceptable and very rare to be happening. There's just really no way of knowing why these things happen. It could have just been a fluke that it happened in the same place within a couple of years.
We understand that there's a question about what to do with the cubs, because they might have learned a predatory behavior and might need to be destroyed along with the mother bear if the mother bear is proven to have been involved in the attack. Your thoughts on that?
Cubs learn everything from their mother, from the day they're born, and then that they'll stay with their mother for up to 2.5 years, learning everything the mothers do to acquire food, where to hibernate, and where they roam within this Yellowstone ecosystem. So at a very young, impressionable age, they got to be part of some really bad behavior. The decision, I think, has been to take those yearlings out of the population and not let that behavior continue as they grow into adults.
But, John, why does that have to happen? I mean, why can't this whole family of bears, the mother and three cubs, why can't they be moved deeper into bear country?
Well, you have to understand that grizzly bears will roam far and wide, and they have great memories. They're very opportunistic as far as where to go and to find food. And even if you relocate them far deep away, unfortunately, I don't think you can take a bear, especially in this ecosystem, far enough away to where they're out of reach of, you know, where people are hikers, backpackers, or certain settlements are, that they will eventually encounter people, or they will come back to the same area.
Well, and what about the campers? Is there any thinking that, you know, maybe campers just shouldn't be allowed to be in areas where, you know, this is a bear corridor? We know that there are bears there.
I think that that's part of the lure of an area like this, or Glacier National Park, or Alaska, or places where bears are. You want to go where you can see these animals, experience them. Again, it has to be emphasized that this is an extremely rare event. There have been 5 fatalities in the park because of bears over the whole history of Yellowstone National Park. So I think people just have to realize that it's still okay to be out there. Just follow all the guidelines. And I'll be out there camping right alongside him.
That's John Heine, director of the Grizzly and Wolf Discovery Center in West Yellowstone, Montana. John, thanks so much. I'm sure everybody there is shaken by this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been a tough couple of days.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, and by the way, John says that the campers who survived did the right thing by fighting back and, in any other case, playing dead. But boy, tough to think of that in that situation. Up next, a compromised energy bill heads to the Senate in 30 seconds here and now. Next week, the Senate is expected to take up that watered-down energy bill. There are no caps on carbon emissions after pressure from Republicans and Democrats from coal-producing states. But the $75 million cap on liability for offshore drilling was lifted, and if the bill passes, that will apply to BP retroactively. To hear more about the Clean Energy Jobs and Oil Company Accountability Act of 2010, let's bring in Darren Samuelson, who covers energy and environmental issues for Politico.com. And Darren, no caps on carbon emissions, no cap and trade, no nothing?
That's right. Senator Harry Reid last week pretty much acknowledged what everyone for a long time had been expecting. He didn't have 60 votes for the cap or the price on carbon emissions. And that was a big blow to environmentalists and to some of the Democrats in the Senate who have been pushing this for a very long time. So Reid pulled the plug on this, and the blame game started almost immediately. People were blaming President Obama primarily for really not pushing hard enough on what he had said long ago was one of his top agenda items on the environment. And there was also blame, you know, pointed at the Republicans for not working with the Democrats on this bill. There was even some blame at environmental groups for spending $100 million campaigning for this bill and not being able to sway a single Republican vote.
Well, and some on the left in the environmental movement were actually against the idea of cap and trade because they thought this idea that companies could buy and sell credits depending on how much carbon they used could be abused by big polluters. So there wasn't even uniform agreement there. But, you know, the polls show that especially in light of the oil disaster in the Gulf, you know, people want something done. Isn't there any sense that there might be pushback? Or, you know, how does the public feel about the idea of carbon emissions?
The connection between the oil spill and the actual carbon emissions reduction bill, the cap and trade bill, is a hard one to make that connection between. The president himself tried to make it in that big Oval Office speech a couple of weeks ago, but he didn't go the whole way. He didn't really sell the idea of the cap and trade system as the solution to the oil spill. Now, the bill itself that we were talking about that was introduced in the Senate and passed in the House last year was primarily aimed at power companies and reducing their reliance on fossil fuels, on coal, eventually switching them, you know, toward natural gas, but also trying to maintain coal for a longer period of time with carbon capture and sequestration. There were studies that showed that it would reduce dependence on foreign oil, but those were questionable studies that a lot of people were wondering, really, how much, you know, would they wean us off of oil and toward other incentives? There are other things out there, incentives for electric vehicles, for example, that's in the bill now that the Senate could be considering. And that kind of thing might be a little bit more geared toward responding to the oil spill.
Well, as you said, the bill includes funds for rebates on energy-efficient home retrofitting, natural gas trucks, electric car research, land and water conservation programs. But also missing is a renewable electricity standard, the RES. Now, this would have required utilities to produce a certain percentage of their energy from renewable resources like wind and solar. And, you know, we are hearing from the American Wind Energy Association. They said this week that new wind development dropped 71% in the first half of this year compared to last. And they said that's in part because industry and investors are seeing there's no will in Washington.
That's right. And basically, the renewable electricity standard didn't get put into the Senate bill. Harry Reid, the majority leader, said that it didn't have the votes. It didn't have 60 votes. The sponsors and the advocates for this were countering and saying, no, we think that we've counted it up, and we think that there are more than 60 votes. Ultimately, something happened there, and Reid just decided he didn't want to make a go at this. And there's a lot of issues behind the renewable electricity standard. There are regional politics at play here where you have certain parts of the country that are willing to go forward with a national standard, especially in the Great Plains. You had a Republican governor or two from Kansas and others urging this to move forward this week, but the southeastern states were really skeptical about being put into a national standard to promote renewable electricity. another big question that I don't think Reid wanted to touch was what exactly falls under the definition of renewable electricity. You had nuclear power advocates saying, hey, well, this should be a renewable electricity source. And you also had the clean coal advocates saying that we should be included in a renewable electricity standard. And ultimately, Reid decided not to go there.
Well, so what's the fallout here? The headline of your recent posting on Politico.com reads, Dems feeling burned on climate. A lot of them newly in office, they have to go back to their constituents in August, and Republicans, in many cases, are promising to put together campaign ads for the fall, pointing out that these Democrats had supported what they, the Republicans, are going to say were expensive climate change initiatives.
That's right. A very important piece of very recent history. The House last June did vote and pass a cap-and-trade bill. Now, it's been stuck in the Senate for more than a year, but Nancy Pelosi was able to convince about 40, 50, you know, swing vote moderate Democrats from the Rust Belt, from southern New Mexico, from blue dog districts like Alan Boyd and the Florida Panhandle to go along and vote for this bill, and then ultimately the Senate didn't respond. And so these House Democrats don't have a law to go back and campaign on. So these House Democrats are going to be pummeled by their Republican opponents saying that they voted to increase energy bills. You're going to see ads saying that the Democrats supported a national energy tax or cap and tax and trying to raise your taxes. And this bill fits into that narrative.
Well, you say some of these House Democrats and potentially I'm imagining Senate Democrats, you know, still feel, look, we're on the right side of history. That doesn't help in the fall, but they feel they're on the right side of history.
Yeah, there's a short-term, you know, obviously political game played here where Democrats are deciding their vote and ultimately either go for this climate bill and for trying to reduce emissions in the long term. But, you know, climate change is something that a lot of Americans don't really see in a day-in, day-out basis, maybe like they do even other traditional environmental problems, whether it be acid rain or you know, seeing fish warnings or the oil spill.
Well, finally, Darren, what are the chances of Senator Reid's compromise package making it through the Senate? And also, how important is it for something to make it through? Because we understand investors and industry are all sitting on the sideline trying to figure out, you know, what to invest in, and they're waiting for this bill to find out.
That's a great question. I think that the Senate bill will be going to the floor, and Harry Reid probably doesn't have the votes when we start. There's some oil patch Democrats from the Senate side, Mary Landrieu and Mark Begich from Alaska, questioning the idea of lifting the liability cap for oil spills to an unlimited amount. They would prefer to keep that at a different level, or at least have a level as opposed to an unlimited amount of money. So a lot of Republicans are just saying it's a political campaign commercial, and so this thing could, you know, ultimately get shelved and not even come up at all. Remember, the Senate has been just polarized on so many issues this year. Couldn't pass a small business bill this past week. On countless issues, Republicans have been forcing 60 votes, and Harry Reid doesn't have 60. He has 59. For this bill, the questions are big, and it's possible that we're going to come back in September after the August recess, and they'll try again on this bill, trying to go into the elections with some sort of oil spill response. And as for investors, I mean, they're probably not going to get the certainty that they want because we're not looking at a carbon price, and that's looking like something that's going to get punted into either next year or, you know, potentially after the next presidential election.
Darren Samuelson, who covers energy and the environment for Politico.com. Darren, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The Tanglewood Music Center in Lenox, Massachusetts, is a place where promising professionals called fellows get a chance to work side by side with members of the Boston Symphony Orchestra at their summer retreat. How intimidating, these rising stars walking where Koussevitzky or Leonard Bernstein once tread. But tenor Tao Papua knows from pressure a violinist gets in his way, he can just tackle him. Tao was once a defensive tackle with the Cleveland Browns, and both New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick and soprano Kiri Takanawa are major influences. Tao is currently a Juilliard student. This week, he makes his Tanglewood debut in a production of Ariadne off Naxos. Here he is rehearsing. And Tanglewood fellow Tao Papua joins us from Lenox, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Thank you.
What is it like for you to be there?
It's been magical. It's been a wonderful experience. Just being handpicked by James Levine. Of course, we all know that our dear maestro had to cancel due to back problems. It's still a blessing to be here amongst all these wonderful, talented artists.
I remember, Tao, reading when you first auditioned for this Tanglewood program with James Levine, who, as we said, isn't at the program because he's injured his back again. But at the time you said, my voice was very rough, but obviously he recognized that I have, you know, a voice. How has it improved? I mean, how has studying changed your voice?
It's changed a lot, not just the timbre and the way I sing, but also the language. Now I love German. You know, when I first got into this opera, I was really scared about it because my German wasn't good. Now I love it. Just working with the maestro Tohnani, it's been incredible.
Well, let's trace your path there because it's fascinating. You were born in Tonga and traveled to Salt Lake City as a 10-year-old. A lot of people come from Tonga to Salt Lake, I think through the Mormon missionaries.
Yes, that's true. My mom and the family, I'm the youngest out of nine, we all got together with my mom's siblings, and we all moved to Hawaii first and then to Salt Lake City, Utah, because my mom's side of family, they are Mormons, but not my mom. But we all travel together.
And there's a huge Tongan community in Salt Lake, actually very active in tennis there.
Yes.
But you took a different sports path, going to Weber State College in Utah on a football scholarship. So when did you discover the voice?
Probably in my mid-20s, when I was at church. We're singing hymns, and a lot of people will turn around and see, you know, where's that voice coming from? And as they turn, they see me standing there singing. I've always been told that I should pursue a music career, but I didn't know how to do it since football was paying my schooling. And then, you know, later on being drafted to the NFL by Bill Belichick.
And he did draft you into the Cleveland Browns. He was with the Browns at that point. He's now, of course, the Patriots coach. But as you get further and further into football, are you getting further away from your dream? I mean, did you confide this to other football players?
Oh, no. I remember there were times that some of the reporters, they will come up to me and ask me in the locker room and say, so we hear that you like to sing classical music, opera. Can you sing something for us like O Sole Mio? I was a little bit intimidated, and so I didn't know what to say. I said, oh, no, I don't sing. You know, I was too embarrassed about, you know, a football player who sings opera.
But at this point, you are injured. You move to New York. And meet soprano Kiri Takanawa. Tell us about that.
Yes, I went to the Metropolitan Opera to see a triple bill of Puccini's Il Trittico. And I saw a huge poster at the bookstore that it had Dame Kiri Takanawa will be there to sign some CDs or DVDs. And I thought, you know, I've never met this lady and I would love to meet her. You know, since she's Polynesian, I'm Polynesian. So I went and stood in line, and they told us that we could write our names on a piece of paper so she could sign to Tau Papua from Kiri Takanawa. And she looked at my name and then looked up, and she realized I was Polynesian. And I told her I was a tenor. And she looked at me and said, are you going to school? And I said, no. And she said, is anyone helping you? And I said, no. And then she looked at me and said, I would like to help you.
Well, she did help you. She got you into a meeting with the head of the voice department at Juilliard, Brian Ziegler, and she asked you to sing for him.
I started singing Recondita Armonia from Tosca. And when I was finished, Kiri turned to Brian Ziegler and said, what can we do for him? And Brian Ziegler said, yes, he does have a voice. But he said, Kiri, I can't just bring him in. He'll have to audition like everyone else. So Kiri turned around and looked at me and said, can you take on this challenge in learning five arias plus a monologue to get into Juilliard? And I looked at her and I said, yes, I can. You know, I've never taken any language classes, you know, in French or Italian. Luckily, the Tongan language, we speak on a lot of vowels, so the Italian language I could read, and I'll have to look up the translation word for word to know what I'm singing about, but it was all right.
Thank you. sounds like it's very, very hard to sort of catch up with people who've been studying opera for years, just even learning the languages. How hard has this been?
It's been very hard, but I think the thing that is saving me is the type of voice that I have singing Bacchus in Ariadne, this opera, takes more of a mature voice, most definitely. I'm blessed to be a tenor. I think if I was another type of voice, I think it would be much more difficult.
More difficult.
Yeah.
Well, but I'm wondering, too, I mean, having spent years playing football, are you ever out there on the stage when just the urge to sort of tackle all the guys carrying swords in the back room overcomes you?
Well, I totally understand where you're coming from. You know, because of my football training, that has helped a lot in my opera studies. Just the discipline or just the warrior attitude of, you know, when you feel down and you want to quit, you can't. Because you remember when you're on the football field and you're on the goal line and you're protecting your goal. With this opera, it's a very difficult tenor role, and I have to dig deep and pull out some of my my football attitude to mentally sing this role.
Maybe you know how many people are jealous of you, both an NFL player and a Tanglewood Fellow.
Oh.
It's almost not fair.
I am lucky. I do have to say I am lucky, and I feel spoiled.
That's tenor Tau Papua. As we said, a former NFL player and now a Tanglewood Music Center Fellow. He's going to be appearing as Bacchus in the TMC production of Ariadne of Naxos beginning this weekend. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Tau, thanks for taking time out of your schedule to speak to us.
You're welcome. Thank you.